Greetings from BBS Radio, where truth and news still exist in the original form. You're tuned into The Spiritual Politician, the show that shows you where politics and government went wrong and how you can take action to make it right. I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster, your host for this hour of personal empowerment. If you have a question or insight, call us toll-free from any place across the world at 1-877-876-5227 or call direct to 530-876-3222. This show is carried online, and you may also be able to get it on the air in your local area. To find out if an old-fashioned on-the-air station in your area carries this show, contact us at bbsradio.com. The website for this show is up and can be found on the BBS Radio site at spiritualpolitician.blogspot.com. All past shows are available now on the station archives. And you can read my own blog at How the Neocons Stole Freedom. blogspot.com. And today we're going to start with an update on Ada L. Smith. You'll remember Ada. We've had several reports on her and her hijinks in New York, where she has assaulted several of her office workers, including her office manager, who joined us as a guest, and that was Doug Green. But this time we have something a little bit different in the Ada Smith story. Someone has written her a song. A journalist in New York who wanted to remain anonymous has written this a darling, adorable piece titled I Am Ada. And if you want to sing it, you can sing it to the tune of I Am 16, going on 17. The journalist dedicated it to Chock Full of Nuts, Ada Smith. Now, I'm not going to inflict my voice on you, but I will read it. I am okay, but stay out of my way. Baby, you'll see me blow. Ask me for ID. Say that I'm heavy. Coffee, I'm sure to throw. Don't need no pipsqueak giving me bullshit. Telling me to behave. Give back the car keys. Restore my Lulu. Pardon me while I rage. Maybe a little tart am I. There's nothing wrong with that. Really, I'm just a peach at heart. But don't you call me fat. I am Ada, queen of the Senate. Don't tell me what to do. I'm okay, but stay out of my way, or I'll go postal on you. And that's our week's update on Ada L. Smith, New York State Senator for Queens. Now, you may have noticed, or perhaps been unable to not notice, that gold has climbed to over $700 an ounce now, and the dollar is headed south and not for a vacation in Rio. Money, currency, the stuff that makes the world go round or just stops everything in its tracks, is worrying all of us today. The balloons are popping all over the country, and real estate is on its way south to Rio, too. As we consider how to be spiritual politicians, making that thing we call government match our highest spiritual vision, we have to be sure to keep money in the picture. More and more of us are beginning to realize just how our hard-earned cash ends up in the pockets of government and their core constituency. They use the institutions of government to steal. And they've been doing it for so long, they have it down to a science and have come to think of it as sort of an entitlement. And many of us don't even seem to notice. Think about that friend of yours at work who bounces in about this time of year telling you, just like they had won the lottery, how much they got back on their tax refund. The fact so many of us have lost sight of what that refund really signifies is one of the reasons we're in this mess today. Be a good spiritual politician for your friend and try to be gentle, but let them know the truth. The money that is not there was stolen. Our guest tonight is someone who's done a lot of thinking about this issue and can help you understand money and explain it to others. Chris Cooper does a series of workshops titled Playing Games with Money. Chris graduated from the University of London and then took a position in Her Majesty's Office of Customs and Excise, and then at Barclays Bank. From there, Chris went entrepreneurial, trying out the pitfalls and rewards of commerce for himself until he discovered what he was meant to do all along, and that is to demonstrate to us just how money works. Chris's workshops are designed to show you how our money is manipulated by government and how you can take back control and heal yourself financially. Since we connect spiritually to all parts of our life, and money is the means that allows each of us to do everything, thinking of money as part of our spiritual reality is something we really need to change. We really need to do to change the system and to really become spiritual politicians ourselves. So I'm very glad to welcome Chris Cooper so he can help all of us heal our financial world. Chris, welcome.
Thank you, Melinda. Pleasure to be here.
And, Chris, we always start by asking our guest to tell us something about himself. So I've told our audience a little bit about you. They know something about what you've done professionally. Tell us something about yourself that's more personal. Tell us about your family.
Well, I was born and raised, as you can tell from my accent, in England. And through going to work for Barclays Bank that you mentioned earlier, I met my wife now of many years in the United States. I was in an international bank, and I came over here on an assignment. And we got married, and we went back to England for a while. Had two children of our own. She has a stepson, or I have a stepson from her previous marriage. And then we adopted a little girl of our own from Romania shortly after that. So we have four children in our brood, three still at home.
How nice. That's a nice-sized family.
And, yeah, most of my family's back in England. Judy's family's down in Georgia, and I'm out on the west coast in Oregon. So we don't often get to visit with each other, but when we do, it's a lot of fun.
So you're sort of spread all over, but you do keep in touch, which is one of the things that makes family work.
Absolutely, yeah. And thanks to the internet and cheap phone calls these days, we can do that very easily.
Yes, well, the market is actually putting some pressure on some parts of the system, isn't it? Which, of course, is why they're scrambling to see if they can figure out a way to have a monopoly on the internet.
Yeah, I really have some concerns about access to the internet in the future. It's been a real boon to me. I don't think I could have got anywhere close to doing the research I've done without that. I mean, just going down to the library and getting books. I mean, a lot of the books that I've been reading are not even available in the library. They're so controversial. So.
And you've been doing that research for a long time now. What really jump-started you, of course, was your background in banking, so that you knew from one viewpoint exactly what was going on in the system, but then having broken out as an entrepreneur, you saw it from a different viewpoint.
I certainly did, yeah. When I was in the bank, I was a middle manager and went through all the professional management training courses, and so I learned what they wanted me to know about the system, and I thought I had it all covered, you know. And then when I made the break to start my own business, I discovered a couple things. First of all, when I came over to Oregon to launch into a completely new career, I realized that I didn't know everything there was about running my own business. Made a complete mess of everything. And that caused me to, you know, look at my knowledge of money in a different light.
Mm-hmm.
And then I started taking some courses with an outfit called Landmark Education, which is worldwide. And I really came to get in closer touch with myself and realized now that as I delve more into money, that the energy of money is such a more interesting and unexplored area for most of us.
And that's an interesting expression that you use, the energy of money, because, of course, the word currency is another word that we use for electricity, which is another form of energy.
Yes, it is. And if you go back into the history and the debates that took place in colonial times and post-colonial, You know, the word current comes up a lot in terms of the currency. And the two are very closely connected, and that's one area that I'm introducing into my workshops and want to talk more about, so I can pass that knowledge to other people.
Mm-hmm. So this is one of the areas that you go into in your workshops, is you talk about the nature of money.
Yeah, there are currently three workshops, and the first one looks primarily at the history and the mechanics, and then the second one goes more into the international aspect of it, and I usually end up by talking about the energy of money and looking at some alternatives to the monetary system that we have.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with the system that we have here in the United States. We have the Fed, and how would you explain the Fed to people?
Well, I think you've actually got to go back a long way to understand how we come to be in our present situation. It really goes back, and this is one of the points I make to people who come to my workshops, is that, first of all, I'm not an expert. You know, I've done a lot of reading, but this is still just a hobby to me. I'm not doing it full time. But I've been able to uncover a lot of information that's actually pretty readily available. And I try and encourage people to look at things through a fresh light, because we grow up learning about money almost ad hoc, you know, through our parents and through our experiences in life. We just accept many things about money. And
mm-hmm.
what I try and encourage people to do is, it's like right now we're looking at money with green-colored spectacles on. And, you know, if you keep those spectacles on for long enough, then everything appears green and everything appears normal. But if you are able to take those spectacles off, you suddenly realize that everything's really not as it seemed to you before. And so I'm kind of a mythbuster when it comes to money, I suppose. And as far as the current monetary system, well, really it's a very long story, but because, you know, it's completely intertwined with the history of money throughout the world.
Well, that's okay. Go have a go at it. It's fascinating.
The history of money, 10,000 years in 10 minutes, all right. Well,
you can have 15,
all right. It starts off with the way that people used to trade when the economies were much, much smaller and the population was much smaller was primarily barter. In other words, you had something that I want, I have something you want, we'll swap them and everybody's happy. But barter gets really complicated really quickly as economies grow and populations grow, because, you know, you might not have exactly what I want, but I've got what you want. We have to involve other people. And very quickly that system gets out of control, because by the time you made all the trades you need to get back to the original person, they might have changed their mind or done a deal with somebody else. So, I mean, barter still exists and it serves a purpose, and it's certainly the origins of money as such. But what people found was that what was much more useful was to find a commodity that was generally accepted by everybody, so that you could hold it and use it to exchange value with other people, and it's something that they all wanted. And this, you know, typically to start off with, you know, thousands of years ago, would have been something like livestock.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I mean, in parts of the world, that still happens. There's nothing wrong with that. It's perfectly legitimate exercise. But something like livestock, for example, has a pretty big downside in that, you know, it doesn't last forever and it's not very transportable. And so people started looking around for other ways of trading. And it wasn't too long before the system got refined into looking at minerals, because they're, you know, pretty valuable for various purposes and they're pretty easy to transport.
And they last.
And they last, yeah. They're not going to degenerate. And of all those minerals, cut a long story short, as most people probably realize, gold and silver stood out head and shoulders above all the others. And
the noble metals.
Indeed, indeed. What happened with gold and silver was that people started transforming them into coins. And coins had a big advantage that once somebody's seal was on them, whether it was Chinese or Romans or whoever, it was it could be generally relied upon, you know, with some misgivings here or there, but it can be generally relied upon to represent a certain value in that particular metal.
Mm-hmm.
What people typically did was to, because even though, you know, gold and silver are much more portable compared to livestock, they are still fairly heavy to carry around and a little bit dangerous as well, living at times when we don't have the security that we have today. So typically people would store their valuable coins with the person who produced them in the first place, which being the goldsmith or the silversmith.
Mm-hmm.
And what the goldsmith would do would be to issue a receipt for the money that was deposited with him for safekeeping. And that receipt, just skipping through a lot of stuff here, but basically the receipt would be generally accepted in the local vicinity because the other people would know the goldsmith, recognize his signature. So instead of someone having to come back to the goldsmith and reclaim their gold to go and pay for something, they could actually use the receipt to make the payment to somebody.
So that became like the first paper money.
It was in the Western culture, yeah. And then what happened was that people started asking the goldsmith for, you know, if they had a $100 deposit, he might just give them one receipt for $100. But as people found it more convenient to actually trade with the paper, they asked him to produce smaller pieces of paper, like 10 $10 receipts, so that they could trade a little bit more easily for smaller items.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that doesn't sound too bad, and it wasn't. But
and this is all private?
This is all private, yeah. But human nature being what it is, unfortunately, it's just the way it was. Goldsmiths realized that any one time, people who were coming to them to reclaim their money were only a very small proportion, represented only a very small proportion of the total amount of gold in their keeping.
Mm-hmm.
So they came up with this idea of, well, hey, if we've only got, you know, 20% of people coming to claim their gold, there's 80% of these coins sitting in the back there doing nothing. What about if I actually create a few extra receipts of my own?
Uh-oh.
And start trading with them myself? You know, no one's going to know the difference. They look exactly the same. I sign them saying that I'm holding this amount of gold. And as they practiced more and more, they found they could get away with more and more. And this is the origins of modern banking. You know, goldsmiths turned into bankers because it became more profitable to issue these false receipts than it did to actually do the goldsmithing in the first place.
So instead of producing jewelry, they produced bank accounts.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And loans.
Banks and loans, yeah. And as far as this country is concerned, we dabbled in central banking, which is what we have now, almost since the beginning. Forgive me if I say we. I count myself as
half
the country. And most of the experiments were disastrous. So it's interesting to find out, and we'll come on to that in a minute, how we ended up with the Federal Reserve, which is the epitome of central banking.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the earliest attempts at central banking was, and it's something that I like to reference to people, it was the Second Bank of the United States. And it didn't have the degree of monopoly that the Fed does today, but what's interesting about the Second Bank is that it was chartered by Congress, and this was back in the 1820s. So they came up against a real worthy opponent in President Andrew Jackson,
mm-hmm.
who understood what the bankers were doing as far as creating money out of nothing and taking advantage of people. And
charging interest on what was essentially not their money.
Exactly. And maybe if we have time, we'll look at one of the games we play, and I can try and describe it to get that proposition across to people so that it's very concrete in their mind.
Now, in the beginning, weren't they actually charging people for storing their money?
They were. And, you know, I don't have a problem with that at all. That's, you know, a legitimate exercise. Where the problems arise for me is that, you know, we've evolved into a system where bankers literally are creating money out of nothing. A couple of the myths I explode early on in my workshop are that first of all, money is created by government. Well, very, very little of it is, you know, a very small percentage. Most of it's created by banks without any control, without any control from government. And the other popular myth that I like to light on early on is that banks lend money that others have deposited. They keep up this facade that you come and put your money with us and we'll pay you a small amount of interest, and then we'll take this money and we'll lend it to other people and we'll charge them a little bit more interest, and our profit will be the difference between what we pay you and what we charge them.
And what is that actually? I'm sure it's much more than any of us know that it is.
What is the...
How much profit do they make? People put their money into the bank, and then the loans are made. How much do the banks really make on that kind of loan?
Well, it's not a fair question, because the reality is that banks are not lending other people's money. Well, the easiest way to explain that is that if they were, then somebody's deposit account is going to get reduced by the equivalent amount of what they're lending out to somebody else. Now, I don't know about you, but my deposit account has never shrunk by anything that I didn't know about by making a deposit myself by a debit or over the counter or with a debit card of some kind.
Mm-hmm. But they do write themselves some sort of credit, and then that's what they loan.
That's all the modern day loans are. They're bookkeeping entries. And so that's what, where people use the phrase creating money out of nothing, that's exactly what happens. And that's one of the things that we help people to understand when we play a game, what I call the Jekyll Island Jive game.
The Jekyll Island?
Jekyll Island Jive. It gets its name from Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia, which is where the meeting took place at the beginning of the 20th century between many storied people, rich, influential financiers, who came up with a plan for establishing the Federal Reserve System. And Jekyll Island is the place that they met and conceived that plan.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also featured in the title of a book by Edward Griffin called The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Yes.
Highly recommended reading to everybody. Anyway, in the Jekyll Island Jive, people get to play different roles in the monetary system. Someone gets to be the Federal Reserve System, someone gets to be the United States government. Then depending how many people we have, we can have different banks involved and different corporate entities. And in a nutshell, how it works is the government originates the whole process. They decide to borrow money, and let's face it, Congress is not shy about borrowing money.
Mm-hmm.
They originate some kind of financial note, a treasury note or a bill, and then they sell it in the open market. Typically, the Federal Reserve will buy them, but, private individuals, overseas governments, there's a whole mechanism for getting these things into the market. But let's say, for the sake of simplicity, the Federal Reserve buys the government security. So I have somebody write out a little note playing the role of the federal government, have them literally hand it over to the Federal Reserve. The person playing the role of the Federal Reserve will then credit the federal government's account and allow the federal government to write checks for different things. So then the person playing the federal government gets to write checks for whatever they want. We usually keep it to something like $1 million, and they can write a couple of different checks, and they'll hand them off to corporations. Whoever's playing the role of the corporation, sitting across the table, they'll receive a check from the federal government, and obviously they have to provide whatever goods or service was contracted for. But the point is that, and this is where the real ploy comes in from the point of view of the bankers, when those checks that commercial companies have received from the federal government get deposited into the bank, the bank has a balance sheet, assets and liabilities. Well, those checks get deposited into the bank, it creates a liability for the bank, but under the bank's rules, or under the rules that are set by the Federal Reserve, the banks get to lend 90%, essentially, it's a complicated formula, but in round figures, they get to lend 90% of all those checks that are deposited with them.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of this $1 million that the government spent, let's say they spent it with just two companies, one for $250,000 and one for $750,000. And I always keep it simple, so there's actually usually just one bank. So all the money goes back into one bank so people can see what happens to it. So the companies then deposit these two checks for $1 million into the ABC bank. The ABC bank, playing by the rules that the Fed has set, is then able to lend 90% of this money out to other people. Well, you might think that's not too unusual or unreasonable, but what then happens is that ABC Bank lends out $900,000 to different companies. Those companies, in turn, have to either deposit the funds back into the bank or they'll write their own checks. In one way, shape, or form or another, those checks are going to end up back at the bank.
Yes.
In somebody's account. So then the bank has $900,000 coming back in. Under the rules set by the Fed, they can then lend 90% of that $900,000, $810,000. And so they keep recycling the original money. And I actually did this calculation myself by hand. I wish I'd used a computer program because it took me forever. But if you keep recycling 90% of the original $1 million, it becomes $900,000, then $810,000, and the calculation took several pages, and when I added up the total, all the money that the banks had lent was $9 million.
So more than they actually started with.
Out of the original $1 million that the government borrowed,
mm-hmm.
$9 million extra debt was created literally out of nothing by the banks, all with the approval of the Fed.
And that all, of course, has to be paid.
It all earns interest for them, yeah. And someone has to pay it. And that's the entire reason why all of the economies of the world are mired in debt. If you look at the headlines in the papers and on TV today, it's all about consumer debt, corporate debt, bankruptcies, Chapter 11, the national debt, third world debt. And 20 years ago, yeah, you could find that kind of thing, but by no means as prevalent as it is now, because we've reached a point where all this debt is becoming perpetual.
So you're saying that this has been sort of a perpetual Ponzi scheme, and it's just now catching up with us?
It's essentially a Ponzi scheme. I mean, the fact of the matter is that people are probably familiar with runs on banks, where it hasn't happened in this country recently, but it's happened. I did a workshop a couple of weeks ago where a gentleman came from, or had been in Argentina 3 or 4 years ago, when the local economy imploded and everybody tried to get their money out of the bank. And the fact of the matter is that everybody's money isn't there. It doesn't exist. You know, the first 3 or 4% of people might get everything out, but beyond that, it's all bookies.
Which is exactly how a Ponzi scheme works.
Mm-hmm. So as long as everyone's confident that their money's in there, they'll keep playing the game and writing out their checks, and no one's any the wiser, but believe me.
And as soon as the money isn't in there, it really isn't in there.
This country's no different from any other. The money is not in there, and you can't get it out. And that represents, lost energy. As long as we're all playing the game, we're fine, but it's like a house of cards ready to come tumbling down.
And that's actually very much an analogy for government, isn't it? Because the only reason government works at all is because we all sort of invest our trust in it.
It is. Unfortunately, it's often misplaced.
Yeah.
Because government, Congress, the Federal Reserve System was set up with the complicity of the government and Congress. And it keeps being perpetuated in that light as well. You know, Congress is happy because it basically has a blank check to write. We all know now, it's fairly common knowledge that the national debt is increasing to ridiculous heights every year, probably before the end of this year, even though they just increased the debt ceiling again not too long ago. fact that interest rates are going up means that before the end of the year, the debt ceiling is going to have to be increased again to $9-10 billion, $10 trillion, and there's no end in sight. And people who claim that, you know, just responsible spending will, you know, cutting back on the amount of money we spend, looking for budget savings, is going to solve the problem, just really don't have a handle on how the debt was created in the first place.
So when you get to this point in your workshops, and people are looking at the fact that, you know, they're really, say, even saying you're on thin ice is perhaps giving it too much tangibility.
Mm-hmm.
What do you say to people when they realize that their world is just that fragile?
Well, you know, one of the things that I do is I offer encouragement. I mean, I'm there to point out, you know, different aspects of money. And, I mean, you've got to be pretty blunt about it. It's a horrific situation we find ourselves in. However, it didn't always used to be this way. Debt did not dominate society in the past and doesn't have to in the future. And there are many brilliant people out there who come up with plans for, you know, retiring existing debt and for having economies run based debt-free.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things I do, is I explain to people, well, you know, this is where we are. And I think it's pretty horrible, but there's actually a lot of different options out there to way forward. And there are a number of different systems in place even today at an informal level that are operating alongside the monetary system that the Fed operates.
Well, we've heard some really bad news here, so why don't you give us some good news and tell us about some of the alternatives?
Well, there are a number of them. I mean, the ones that come to mind off the top of my head, there are all sorts of local currencies. It was, I think, about 20 or 30 years ago that a fella out in Ithaca, New York, came up with an idea for a local currency, and that's probably the most well-known local currency in this country, and one which many other towns have based their models on. Out here in Portland, Oregon, we have an equivalent model called Cascadia Hours Exchange, and what the Ithaca model proposes is that it's kind of a centralized system. There's a group of people who form an organization, and they create their own currency.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing illegal about that. A lot of people raise their eyebrows, but, you know, unless you're trying to counterfeit Federal Reserve notes, then there's no reason why you can't go and create your own currency, paper currency or coin, for that matter.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you don't try and you know, palm them off fraudulently and pretend they're something that they're not, or say that they're legal tender, which obviously they're not. So, I mean, you could use the monopoly notes for that matter if people are prepared to accept them, and that's the key, obviously, is will anybody accept them? Well, if you do it through a local group, which people join voluntarily, then they know exactly what they're getting into.
Mm-hmm.
And so you find all sorts of people signing up for this, from, you know, mechanics to massage therapists to dentists. It's completely voluntary and completely open to whoever wants to participate. So you get a group of people who subscribe to Ithaca Notes or Cascadia Hours, and what they get in return is pieces of paper that describe the local currency, and they're usually, you know, got a local flavor to them, they've got some artwork on them, and they're very pretty, and you haven't had to borrow anything to cause them to come into existence. They've just
mm-hmm.
been printed. And they get passed around the community. Another nice thing about local currencies, community currencies, is that they do tend to stay in the community, because, you know, if they get too far outside of the locality, then people will look askance at them and won't recognize them and won't accept them from you. So for all those people who, you know, are anti Walmart, then they will probably seize on the local currency, because there's no chance that Walmart's going to accept them and then ship all those dollars back to Arkansas.
Mm-hmm.
So community currencies, you know, there's probably 70 or 80 towns in the United States.
That many?
Yeah, there are. And it's a growing number.
And is it growing fast now?
Excuse me?
Is it growing fast? Are there more people taking this, you know, this alternative?
I think with the growth of the Internet, people are stumbling across these things a lot more frequently, and they're really not that difficult to set up.
Mm-hmm. What about something like eGolf? That's actually on the Internet.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you can do a Google search for, you know, Ithaca's the probably the best place to start out at. They have their own link of many other towns and currencies that they know about. And they exist in other countries as well. And you can actually borrow Ithaca dollars. They've made a loan of, I think, the equivalent of about $30,000. So that's one possibility. It's you know, in the overall scheme of things, it's, you know, not going to replace Federal Reserve notes, but it's just something that's there in people's armory, and I use them, and I find it a lot of fun to carry them around. Something else that's out there, which is a little more formal, is a group that started out by another name, but I believe goes by Liberty Dollar, I think their website. Most of these places are linked off of my website, so you can find them through there. But libertydollar.org, I believe it is. This was an organization started by a fellow out in Hawaii called von Nothausen, and he had a background in issuing currency. Of course, Hawaii has an interesting background of its own before it became part of the United States. But von Nothausen created this currency, and what he did was he offers three different types of Liberty Dollars. You can buy gold and silver coins, which contain an actual amount of intrinsically valued gold or silver. So if you buy a $20 silver coin, which I have, then it has 1 ounce of silver in it. Now, if you look at the market value of silver, it's not technically worth $20, but, you know, he's got to cover his costs and then of production and safekeeping and transportation and so on and marketing. So, you know, you buy his dollars, and it costs you a little bit over the odds, but, you know, the way that gold and silver are going right now, it could be a good investment.
Yes, not a bad bet at all.
And you can trade those. You actually get a video when you buy stuff from him, and he shows you just how he has gone along to stores, and he uses his gold and silver dollars. They look really nice. People like them. And you can't pay them into a bank, so there are some downsides. And again, you mustn't obviously pass them off as legal tender. But his experience is that they're very widely accepted because people like the feel of them. I mean, it's a wonderful feeling to have real gold and silver in your hand.
Yes, and it's been a long time since Americans had that.
It sure has. And he also issues warehouse certificates, which are pieces of paper like the original receipts that goldsmiths used to issue, pieces of paper that have a particular value, say $10, but they are literally backed by the equivalent amount of silver or gold held in a warehouse somewhere. And the certificate
itself...
Sort of
like we're going back to the goldsmiths. That was what they were originally supposed to do, right? Warehouse your money.
That's right. And if you, just to get off track a little bit here, since you mentioned that, it's real interesting to go back to the United States Constitution, because when the Founding Fathers were establishing our monetary system, it was a matter of extreme debate back then as to how it's going to operate. And there's so much to talk about, but the one thing that I'd like to draw people's attention to is that there was one enormously important change that took place between the drafting of the Articles of Confederation and the drafting of the final Constitution, as far as monetary powers of Congress are concerned. And that is that the Articles of Confederation gave Congress the power to, and these are the actual words, kind of old-fashioned, but the words are to emit bills. Now, basically, emit bills means to issue paper currency. So the Articles of Confederation gave Congress the power to issue paper currency. But a few years later, when it came to finalizing the Constitution, those words were deliberately left out after much debate. And so the way the Constitution reads now is Congress shall have the power to coin money. Now, it used to be coin money and emit bills, but they left the emit bills off.
And why why was that?
Well, I would argue that they knew exactly what they were doing, that they did not want Congress to have the power to issue paper money, because they knew what had happened with paper money in the past, both in the colonies and in Europe and in China, where they've been using paper money for some time, was that it invariably leads to corruption and inflation and government getting out of control.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would challenge people to, or I would invite them to, you know, look at the Constitution, look at some of the background to it, and ask some of their elected representatives, you know, why it is that Congress has actually supposedly delegated authority to the Federal Reserve to emit bills, effectively.
Which really brings us back from just a moment to the whole issue of the Fed.
Yep.
So we have these Jekyll Island people, and this we're looking back at 1913 is when Congress authorized the Fed.
Right.
And tell us, who is the Fed?
Well, I don't think the Fed is the ultimate the power in this game, and I don't actually pretend to know who is, but the Federal Reserve System is a really interesting animal. It's based on the Bank of England, which was the original central bank established in 1694. The Fed followed in 1913, as you said, Melinda, and it took that long for the money powers to be able to establish central banking in this country in the format in which they wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it took so long was that there were, fortunately, some astute politicians along the way, Andrew Jackson being one of them, who refused to recharter the Second Bank of the United States, which was one of the attempts at central banking early on. And that's one of the things I explain to people, is that, you know, back in Jackson's day, the 1830s, money, currency, was a matter of intense public debate. Everyone was educated on the subject. Everyone had an opinion. And yet now, we just take it as read, well, money is what it is. And I'm here to say that money is not what you think it is. And there are lots of different versions.
But anyway. Let me ask another question. If we hadn't returned to a central bank after Jackson, because obviously we did, because here we are.
Exactly.
And we had done what the original intention seemed to have been, do you think that something like town currencies, like you're seeing people try to issue now, would have been one of the solutions that America would have adopted?
Oh, I'm sure it would have been. I'm sure it would have been, yeah. You know, some of the people who've done a lot of research into this subject, like Dr. Edwin Vieira, Edward Popp, they've all got their proposals. Edward Griffin, who wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island. What I like about these people is they don't just identify and expose the problem, they have solutions. And, you know, not everyone agrees, and, you know, I'm not even sure what I'd recommend at this point. I've got a lot more research to do on the subject. But there are ways out of this. Community currencies are part of it. But it used to be that people could mine gold and silver in this country and take it along to the local mint and have it minted for a pretty nominal charge.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the prime ways that money was put into circulation in the economy. No one had to borrow anything.
Mm-hmm. And if people didn't want to carry around gold or silver coins, they would have been able to perhaps find a local town that would have issued paper that then held the coins or something like that.
Mm-hmm. So going back again to one of the things you asked me about alternatives to the system, so there are a lot of alternatives. And it's not that one is right and one is wrong. Edward Popp suggests that people and corporations, for that matter, are issuing their own certificates of credit. You know, there's nothing to stop you or I or, you know, the local electricity company from issuing a certificate of credit. You know, they would presumably identify what they're likely receipts were from sales of electricity for the coming year, and then they could just, you know, with the legal formalities observed, obviously, they could just write out certificates of credit for the equivalent amount, and they could spend those into the local economy. and people will recognize them because, you know, being a big utility, people have confidence in them, and they could use it to pay their bills for their office rent, or, you know, maybe not for their worker salaries. I don't know how that would go down, but for other raw materials. And so these certificates of credit issued by local corporations, I mean, we have that in the form of, Starbucks cards. You know, lots of stores are issuing their own cards, and those are effectively the modern form of certificate of credit.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes, they are, of course. You don't really think about it that way, but it is.
I could if I wanted to. I mean, if I get a Starbucks card, I tend to spend it myself. But, I mean, it does have value. If I wanted to, give it as a gift or, you know, buy something from somebody else, it's not commonly done, but it's perfectly feasible. But I could do a small transaction with a Starbucks card. Someone might, let me buy a packet of cigarettes with a Starbucks card, and so that would start circulating. And that comes back to the word currency that we touched on right at the beginning, and the relationship to energy. Currency essentially is anything that circulates in the economy and is used as a medium of exchange.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't have to be the legal tender, Federal Reserve note, that most of us use these days. It could be community currencies, it could be Liberty Dollars, it could be certificates of credit that we've issued or local corporations have issued.
It seems like when you're talking about the Starbucks, if you have a prosperous business, a business like that actually could, in effect, issue its own, like you're saying, issue its own currency, and then there could be a trade between the currencies of companies and towns.
Yeah, and sometimes people come back to me, well, that's very unwieldy, and how would we know if it was actually legitimate or not? We haven't even started to explore the idea, and it's very feasible given modern technology. I mean, most stores these days are still pretty happy to accept a local check. There really would be no difference.
Mm-hmm.
And there are electronic means of verifying those, and this would be a very legitimate use for a bank.
Mm-hmm.
For them to come up with, a bank could put itself out there as offering the service of verifying various certificates of credit. You know, with the technology we have, that's not a difficulty these days. So there will be, admittedly, there will be a lot of different types of currency circulating, and they will be different from what we have now, but it would certainly be acceptable and a usable option.
And one of the advantages, of course, would be is it would cost us less, because what we're really paying for is the fungibility of being able to trade, of having money.
Yeah, all of this money would be spent into the economy instead of borrowed into the economy. And so you wouldn't have all these associated debt. And, the problem with repaying the debt that we have, of course, is that one of the concepts that people need to, or I would like people to grasp, is that every dollar, every pound, every euro, every currency that exists in the world today, everybody's account, all those different currencies have been borrowed by somebody at some point. And if we ever start to repay them, well, let's just say that the debt right now is $8.5 trillion in round figures. People say, well, that's not a good thing, so let's repay it. Well,
how?
Setting aside the problem of how you do it, if you could, what would the impact of that would be is that you would be taking all this money out of circulation, because the money we have only exists because it's been borrowed. So you repay all the debt, take all the money out of circulation, and that's a classic example of a depression.
Oh, yes. So the question is how to make the transition.
Right.
And that's something we have to decide to do as individuals and find the alternatives.
That's something that needs to be debated, yeah. Like I said, there are a lot of options out there. Smarter men than me have been working on it for a long time, and it would be a matter for debate. But, what we need to do at this point is get a groundswell of people who understand where our current system is and the defects of it, and look at some alternatives and start talking amongst ourselves about it.
Could you give us some recommendations, please? First, give us your website so people can get in touch with you and find out about your workshops.
Sure. The website, I should start off by saying that it doesn't have a www in it. So it starts off http://. Playing games with money, all four words run together, playing games with money, .home.comcast.net.
Okay, and I will put that, that's up on my spiritual politician site too, so people can find it there. Now, you said that there were some books that people could get and read. Could you give us a couple?
The one that would be top of any list that I produce would be The Creature from Jekyll Island, by Edward Griffin. And as far as I know, it's not available in local bookstores because it does cover material that the powers that be would rather we didn't know. So you can, I don't know his website off the top of my head. He's got a good website which has a lot of good information on it. You could Google search Edward Griffin, Creature from Jekyll Island.
Well, we'll make sure that people do that and we'll get it up on our site too.
And to be honest, I can't remember if I'm pretty sure I got a link on my website. I got a lot of different links. I'm gradually building the list of links to encourage people to go there. I would love for people to sign up for my newsletter, because if they're around the country, then they may not have the opportunity of coming here to Portland, which is where I'm based right now. But I'll be getting a newsletter going in the summer, and that'll raise a lot of these issues and some of the alternatives, and I'll be starting to take on some campaigns and see if we can get some concerted action going around the country.
We're going to have, absolutely, and you'll have to come back on the show so we can talk about that later, too. Now, Chris, thank you so much for being with us tonight. I know that our listeners have gotten a tremendous amount of information about money and changes that they can make in their life. And you've, just brought a lot of questions to our attention that needed to be there. So thank you so much for being with us tonight and for sharing the information. And could you just once more give us your website?
Yes, once more. It's http://playinggameswithmoney.home.comcast.net.
Great.
Thanks, Melinda, for the opportunity.
Thank you so much for being with us tonight, Chris.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that's our show for tonight, Friday, May 12th. 2006. Money really does matter if you use it correctly. Now, you know a lot more about how government has managed to grab the gold for themselves, and you have some ideas about how you can heal your own financial future and start enjoying a part of your life that for most of us is just painful. And I think Chris has shared with us why that is, which a lot of us didn't know. Really knowing helps each of us continue our own spiritual evolutionary process so that we can be better people. Thanks again to Chris for his help on that path. As each of us struggles to be free, we all appreciate help in understanding what we need to know. And being free, knowing ourselves, and accepting who we are is the point of life, isn't it? To be free is to own yourself. To own has several meanings, and one of these is actually to acknowledge. Owning your life is therefore admitting your faults and becoming uniquely a better person. Thanks to all of you for being with us, for listening and thinking about where we are and where we want to go from here. Life is process, and in this way we're working to help all of us understand that government is a tool, at times complex, at times devious, at times simple, but just a tool intended to do for us what we cannot do for ourselves. On this show, as we do with all our shows, we end by reading the section of the Declaration of Independence that is America's mission statement. A mission statement encapsulates where we want to go and how we want to get there. But it's up to each of us to ensure that we arrive at the destination. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed, that whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Prudence indeed will dictate that governments long established should not be changed for light and transient causes, and accordingly all experience has shown that mankind are more disposed to suffer while evils are sufferable than to right themselves by abolishing the forms to which they are accustomed. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evidences the design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. When we know, when we understand, when we have the truth, we are armed to take action for ourselves and for the true betterment of all of those around us. Know the truth, and the truth will set you free. This is Melinda Pillsbury Foster, coming to you from BBS Radio. God bless the journey that brings us to freedom. May God be with you every step of the way. Good night.
You have been listening to BBS Radio, a blogandservice.com production and a service to others endeavor. Thank you very much for tuning in to our radio program, and we wish you much peace and joy on your journey.